There's a series of handouts on the table back there if you didn't get them. If you weren't here last week, the one from last week explains the agenda for the semester and the psalms that we will be dealing with. How many people were not here last week? Okay, then I'll reiterate this real quick. We have 13 weeks together, so we're not doing all 150 psalms. I hope you're not disappointed. But I've tried to select various psalms from the five sections that the book of Psalms is divided up into, and we'll sort of get a taste of the psalms and see how they, the major themes that they deal with. All right, and today we are going to focus on the first, and as we look at the first, we will try to answer the question of why it is the first, and also what it is that it being the first tells us about the book of the Psalms, but also about the people who put the book of the Psalms together. And I hope he's closing that door. Is that what he's doing out there? Good. All right. Well, as I told you last week, we're going to, since the book of Psalms is a book of prayers, we're going to use that as our prayer liturgy this time. So we're just going to begin with the psalm and let it stand on its own. In the handout, I gave you four versions of the text, and I'm going to read as our prayer the one that is probably most familiar to most of you in this room, as I can tell by your hair colors and colors that you've put in your hair. And that is the authorized version. Pardon?
Thanks for noticing.
And it looks good. All right. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. The ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. Amen. Okay. Now, one of the points that I made last week is that the book of Psalms is referred to in the rabbinic tradition and in the Christian tradition as being the Psalms of David. And of course, the people who refer to that, and we have this wonderful statement in the earliest rabbinic commentary on the Psalms, that Moses gave Israel the five books, and David gave Israel the five books of the Psalms. And we talked about how the book of Psalms is divided up into five sections as a parallel to the five books of Moses. Many of the Psalms begin with that phrase, Mizmor la David, or a Psalm of David. Psalm 1 doesn't, which is kind of startling, since the book itself is generally understood to be the books of the prayers of David. Okay? Granted, everybody knows that they're not all written by David. But you would think that a book that is going to be attributed to David would begin with that introduction, that it is a Psalm of David. But it's not. It has no introduction. It has no attribution to anyone or for any purpose. It is what is known as an orphan psalm. And the orphan psalms are the psalms that don't have an attribution. Okay, they don't say a psalm of Asaph or a psalm of Korah or a psalm of David. So it's somewhat ironic that the first psalm, the one that is batting leadoff for the 150, has no attribution. Nevertheless, the Midrash Tehillim that we talked about last week, this very important early rabbinic commentary on the Psalms, refers to Psalm 1 as the choicest of all Psalms. And so the question is, why in the world would they call it the choicest of all Psalms? There has to be a reason for that. And first and foremost, in the selection of Psalm 1 as the first Psalm, and it being designated as the choicest of all psalms, is the theme of the centrality of God's Torah, which is God's instruction or God's teaching. How many of you were here last night or at the 8:30 service and have heard Rob already this weekend? Oh, a few of you. Okay, there are parallels between what Rob had to say this morning and what Psalm 1 has to teach us as well. But it is God's Torah, his teaching or his instruction in the life of the individual and its indispensable role in the definition and the attainment of righteousness that makes it why the people who put the Bible together made this one number one. And as we talked about this last week, many of the Psalms themselves represent the entirety of the history of ancient Israel. Okay, they do not follow a chronological order. Some of them are situated in and are tied to events that you can read about in the book of Kings or Chronicles or Samuel. Many of them are so generic that they're impossible to understand what their specific context is. Others of them are clearly reflecting the situation of being in exile in Babylon. Okay, so they're covering this whole period. So the book of Psalms itself does not exist as a book in the time of David. Okay, this is something that is a post-exile collection. That is, and they have selected these prayers that have been, in many ways, the lifeblood of the people of Israel, particularly in exile, when they have no longer a place to fulfill the rituals, the avodah, or the services, the sacrifices of the temple, because they have no access to a temple when they're in Babylon. Okay, so many of these things are what sustain them. And then once we get back to the post-exile period and we have the time period of Ezra and these guys when the Bible seems to be coming into its shape and the texts that had been preserved over centuries are being edited and selected and put together, some of them being left aside. Those of you who have read the historical books of the Bible, you know that the Bible itself cites a number of chronicles or a number of historical books. And this is dealt with in more detail in the book of so-and-so. And it's like, well, where is that book? Okay, and that's very frustrating for the historian in me that we don't have those books. But we know that this process of putting things together is a very late thing, not necessarily contemporary to the events that they might describe. But what's important for our purposes in this class and why this Psalm 1 is known as the choicest of all psalms is that it is the Torah of God, the instruction of God, that it represents the divine outreach to his human creation. And this is a point that I emphasized significantly last week, that in the what comes to be known as the Torah or the prophets, God is speaking to men and to women, to people. In the Psalms, it is people who are speaking to God. And so we have the relationship is inverted there. And the Psalms represent human striving for contact with God. If you look at the Ten Commandments, and we have a couple of versions of them, and they begin with, I am the Lord your God. And they conclude with your neighbor. Okay, you're not to covet that which is your neighbor's. Okay, so they begin with concern of who is the Lord your God, who is Yahweh, and they conclude with your neighbor. The book of Psalms symbolizes movement in a reverse direction. And they commence with this one, blessed is the man, as it says in the King James, or happy is the man, as it says literally in the original. And they conclude with hallelujah. Okay, praise Yahweh. Praise the Lord. Okay, so they begin with man and conclude with God. Okay, so we have the reverse order there. Now, the connection between Torah and Psalms can also be seen in the initial word of the Psalms, and that is this word here, Ashrei, which is translated in the King James as blessed, in the NIV as blessed. I gave you the New Revised Standard and the New Jewish Publication Society translation, which uses happy. Okay, and happy is a more accurate rendition of that. The standard word for blessed is this word here, baruch. And this is we find this over and over and over again throughout the Hebrew Bible. Baruch, well, if anybody been to a Jewish home where they actually said prayers over the meals or been to a Seder or anything like that. They always begin with, Bruch Ata Adonai Melech HaOlam. Blessed are you, O Lord, ruler of the universe. Okay, and blessing, there is a command concept to that. Okay, there is something that you can confer on someone. Happiness is a state of being. This is not something that you can confer on someone else. Okay, and so the psalm specifically is not using this word. Okay, now, if once you have achieved this state of being, then you are feeling rather blessed. Okay, but there's a choice in why these words are used, and this is also the first word, and this is in the handout, the first word of Moses' final statement just before his death. He uses the exact same word. It says, "Happy are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord? Who is like you, a people saved by Yahweh, the shield of your help, the sword of your triumph?" He's not saying you are a blessed people. He's saying you are happy. You're in a state, okay, not a political state, but you're in a state of being. Why? Because you have the blessing and you have the saving of God. A hymn that we sang today, who is the God who saves? Okay, and it is our God who can do that. And the choice of this psalm as Psalm 1 makes each major division each major division of the Hebrew Bible, of the Old Testament, as it's organized in the Jewish tradition, begin with a reference to Torah. And I mentioned this last week, and I said we'd look at it in a little bit more detail today, and so we are going to do that. The former prophets in the Jewish ordering of the Hebrew Bible begins with the book of Joshua. Okay, Joshua is the first of the former prophets. And if you look at your handout from last week, it's all broken down how that works out. But in Joshua chapter 1, we have a specific invocation of God's Torah. And he says, "Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to act in accordance with all the law," or all the Torah, or all the teaching. Okay? And Christian Bibles tend to translate it as law. The Jewish translation, the New Jewish Publication Society, invariably uses the word teaching or instruction, because the concept of law is much too narrow, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. But being careful to act in accordance with all the teaching that my servant Moses commanded you, do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, so that you may be successful wherever you go. This book of the teaching shall not depart out of your mouth. You shall meditate on it, or in the literal word text, you will recite it day and night, so that you may be careful to act in accordance with all that is written in it. For then you shall make your ways prosperous. Then you shall be successful. So here in the very beginning of the former prophets, the second division of the Hebrew Bible as it's laid out in for the public readings for the community is the invocation of Torah. The latter prophets begins with the book of Isaiah. And Isaiah chapter 1 calls upon Israel to hear the word of the Lord, give ear to our God's instruction. Give ear to our God's Torah. The final chapter of the prophetic division, the book of Malachi, which, as we talked about last week, is not a separate book, but all of the 12 minor prophets are called the book of the 12. Okay, so they're all sort of lumped together in a single scroll because they're so little short ones. But he, in the book of Malachi, at the very end, invokes the same concept. Be mindful of the teaching of my servant Moses, of the Torah of my servant Moses, whom I charged at Horeb with laws and rules for all Israel. And then the book of Psalms opens the third division of the Hebrew Bible, the writings, the sacred writings, and here we have the editors who collected these things and put them in their proper order as they decided. The emphasis is on Torah. And they've divided the books, the whole collection of 150 Psalms, into five separate sections. And it is referred to, and this is a self-conscious decision to equate the book of Psalms with the Torah as a whole, with the five books of Moses. So to study the Psalms, to recite the Psalms, is to study and to recite God's teaching, God's instruction. Hence, the rabbis call it the choicest of all Psalms. And we also know that it's in this time period, in the post-exile period of ancient Israel, where we begin to find a greater emphasis on study of Scripture as an act of worship, something that was not even possible, certainly in the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or the early periods of Israelite history, because writing was so limited, and writing was not something that people had access to. Literacy was not something that people had access to. But as we work our way closer to the year zero, okay, as our calendar is moving up towards the year zero, this formal act of study becomes a more and more important part of ancient Israelite and emerging Jewish ritual practice and worship. So another thing which is interesting about this particular psalm is that the overwhelming majority of the psalms that we find in the book of Psalms are lamentations or praises, okay, where they are pouring out their heart to God in anger or pain or supplication or raising their voices in praise. This one has neither. There is no lamentation. There is no real praise in it. It's not really a devotional psalm as we might define, or we tend to define, devotion or devotional piety nowadays. I would argue that our definition of piety is a little bit narcissistic, a little bit focusing on the self more than the Psalms requires or even advocates. And I think that this rather self-centered notion of piety obscures the fundamental principle that the editor sought to highlight by according the theme of Torah as a preeminent position in the Psalms. The very study of the sacred text itself constitutes a pious act. And the fact that there is a sacred text by the time that these texts are being collected indicates how important that has become. And we're going to see this emphasis on Torah and the need to study it, to recite it, as the King James translates it and most English translations since then, meditates on it, is reiterated and emphasized over and over again in Psalm 19 and then in Psalm 119. And as I told you last week, we're not doing 119. We don't have time. Okay, that one is a reciting psalm. You can see why that would be a recited psalm, because it's a call and response all the way through it. And those of you, you can go home, and if you're married, husbands read the first part, wives the second, or vice versa, or whatever. That was an attempt at humor, but it obviously failed. Okay? Now, when the psalmist begins by declaring, okay, and this is an intensive plural form of this verbal noun, okay? You don't need to know the grammar of it, but you need to know that this is an intense form of happiness. You can say, like, oh, happy is the one, or how happy is the one, how happy is the man. He's describing an existing reality. He's not describing something that is a goal for the future, okay? He's describing an existing reality. And it's neither a natural state nor the result of thinking happy thoughts or the result of the power of positive thinking. Happiness is a result from a deliberate commitment to a certain way of life, a course that is governed again by God's instruction, by God's teaching, by God's Torah. And the singular nature of this enduring condition of happiness is illustrated by this careful term, Ashrei instead of Baruch, as I mentioned at the outset. Baruch has a connotation that you can invoke that on someone else. Ashrei in the Bible always has a human being as its referent. Baruch has God as the referent frequently, almost all the time. Okay, you're blessed. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. You know, this very famous opening from Psalm 103 that we sing frequently as well. All right, so, and this word here really doesn't have an antonym. It doesn't have an opposite, okay? Whereas Baruch does. You know, there's blessed, and then there's damnation, okay? So, I mean, there are stark opposites there. So the condition that the psalmist is emphasizing here is very much a this worldly condition. Okay, it's not an otherworldly state of happiness. It's not something that you achieve later on. It's today. It's now. And another thing which is interesting here is that it is an individual that is the focus of the psalm, not a class of people. And it talks about three classes of people in the plural. In the second part of the first part of the psalm, it talks about the wicked, talks about the sinners, talks about the scoffers. These are used in the plural, but it is the individual who is the happy one. And there are reasons why he is in this state of happiness. And throughout the Bible, you find this it's very clear that there a requirement for being in a state of moral virtue, I guess, is to avoid situations that are going to lead you astray. Okay? And we see that quite clearly in this psalm. And so Psalm 1 begins by emphasizing virtue in the negative. Okay? The happy person has not walked in the counsel of the ungodly. He's not standing in the path of sinners or sitting in the seat of the scornful. And the Hebrew Bible is very much aware of the rather dark side of human nature and the whole range of human corruptions, and it has a number of terms to describe that. And the first one that is used in the psalm is the term wicked. And the word that is, and it's used in the plural here. And the word that is used to describe the wicked is in your handout. An individual wicked person is a rasha. And it does have an antonym. It has the antonym is tzaddik, which is where we, you probably have heard of the Sadducees. They are the tzaddikim. They are the people who are taking this title for themselves. But as you all know, they did not believe in the resurrection. Therefore, they were sad, you see. So,
you got that one.
Yeah, I use that one every time, and it helps you keep them straight. But when you look at what this word rasha means, it means someone who is a judge to be in the right, in the wrong, and a tzaddik is someone who is a judge to be in the right. Joseph is referred to as a tzaddik. Okay? He is one of those who is righteous. He is adjudged righteous because of what he chose to do, also what he chose not to do. Right? And the wicked, there is a ton of examples of the wicked, particularly in the book of Psalms, in the book of Proverbs. They're arrogant, they're proud, they're narcissistic, they're insolent, they're derisive, they're contemptuous, they plot evil in their bed, they terrorize the weak. And just a little parenthesis here, most of the weak that we look at in the Hebrew Bible, the widow, the stranger, the orphan. These are their favorite targets. And why is it that these people are weak? Why is a widow weak? Why is a stranger weak? Why is an orphan weak? What do they all have in common? They have no protector, but who is your protector? There is no family. Okay? They have no family. They have no, a widow has no husband. An orphan has no parents. The stranger has no kin. Okay, so the person who is without kin in the tribal society of ancient Israel is the person who has no protection in that society. And these are the ones that the wicked prey on. Okay? And there are a whole host of other kinds of examples, and you just go to the back of your go to your concordance and look up the word wicked, and you'll be amazed at how many folks are in there. But the wicked are, they're wicked, they're motivated by their base desires, of course, but the wellspring of their wickedness is really, according to the Psalms in the Bible, is a false understanding of the nature of God that convinces them that they can perpetuate their evil without consequence. What do we mean by this? They believe that God is removed from this world. He's indifferent to human behavior. And consequently, the wicked neither put their trust in God, nor do they fear him, because he's not here. He's not present. He's not imminent. The biblical understanding of the moral order of the universe is completely the opposite to that. That wherever you are, God is there. All right? Now, less villainous than the wicked are the sinners. And for that reason, maybe they have a little bit more of appeal, because the truly wicked are, they're beyond the pale. But the sinners are much more appealing because they're not that bad. So the sinner is the one who strays from the path, somebody who misses the point. Okay, somebody who errs or strays or misses the point, not somebody who is willfully and volitionally evil. That's what this word means. He's less reprehensible than those who are the wicked in his moral failings. But the sinners referred to, the way that this term is used, is these are the guys who are the habitual moral blunderers. Okay, theirs is a chronic condition. They are hardened sinners. And consequently, fellowship with them, hanging out with them, standing in their way, is a perilous thing to do. And so it says that the happy man does not stand in their way. It doesn't mean that you stand in their way to block them. It means that you stand in their way and hang out with them. Okay? That you do not he does not linger on their paths. And the idea here is that he's not even attracted by them. He doesn't consider whether or not to take their path. The temptation is not there. Now, this is a rather stark contrast here, and it tends to overlook the reality of the human condition, that temptation is always there. But this is the dichotomy that is being set up in this psalm. And the truly happy person, there is no uncertainty, there's no vacillation, there's only unequivocal rejection of the base practices of the sinner. And the third category is the scoffer. And it's oftentimes translated as scornful or mockers or cynics or these kinds of things, and all of those terms work. A scoffer is frequently associated with the foolish, with the arrogant, and with the wicked. And one of the things that you do need to bear in mind, if somebody is a fool or someone is given to folly, it doesn't have to do with their mental capacities in the biblical use of this term. It is someone who is without moral judgment, someone who is lacking in discrimination or moral judgment. The inability or the unwillingness to see the consequences of one's actions. And many of the passages in Proverbs and Psalms and elsewhere speak of the scoffer as outrageously proud and insolent. He's a menace to the social order because he's always tearing things down. And the psalm says that he does not sit in the seat of the scoffers. And I was looking for an image, and it's a good thing I didn't spend too much time finding it because the projection system's not working today. In a city gate in the cities of ancient Israel, all of the cities that are cities are walled because you have to keep out predatory animals and predatory people. But a gate, let's say the city is round, a gate will have, now this is certainly not to scale, okay? But a gate will kind of look like this. And and then you can kind of get into the city. But it's in, and there are benches all around here. Okay, and this is where the men sit. Those of you who have read Proverbs 31, it talks about the virtues of the woman, and anybody notice that she does all the work, so that her husband can sit in the gate and say, "My wife is really good because she does all the work, and I sit around all day." Right? Because that's the division of labor in these kind of societies. Okay? So you sit in the gate and you poke fun at people, make light of things. And so you're not going to be sitting in the city gate and being a scoffer. Okay? The happy person does not do that. All right? So the decent individual will have nothing to do with the scoffers. He shuns their gatherings, and I'm sure that's a lot of fun to do those things. So the essential preconditions in this psalm for the formation and the improvement of character, for the spiritual and moral elevation, have been laid out in verse 1. And you probably, anybody who's ever heard a sermon on Psalm 1, you've noticed this, and it's been pointed out to you, that the acts of distancing are expressed by a means of sequence of three verbs which convey increasing degrees of closeness: walking, standing, and sitting. Okay? Now, in sharp contrast to the bad guys, we see that the good guy concentrates his spiritual and intellectual energies on God's teaching, on God's Torah. Rather, the teaching of the Lord is his delight. And the person is thoroughly absorbed in the teaching of the Lord. Torah Yahweh. What does it mean to be the teaching of God, of Yahweh, the personal God of Israel? And so the question is, what does this mean in the context of Psalm 1? The word book does not appear in this psalm. Okay, so we're not talking about the book of the Torah. We're not talking about the five scrolls of the Pentateuch. Okay? There is no definite article there. It's not talking about the Torah. It's talking about God's teaching. So here in this psalm, Torah must simply mean instruction or teaching. Nevertheless, we find in verse 2 that we're told that he recites it day and night. So there must be something that is written down. There must be some identifiable text that is in the mind of the psalmist. The Hebrew verb that the King James translates as meditates, and almost all other English translations follow the King James's lead, the verb itself carries a decidedly oral connotation to it. It's used to describe the moaning of a dove or the growl of a lion. And it almost always takes the mouth as the subject. The mouth or the tongue or the palate of one's mouth is the subject of this verb, almost always when it is used in the text. So meditate is not an incorrect translation. It is an incomplete translation. And what I mean by that is that the understanding of the action as recitation, not merely meditation in quiet contemplation, is reinforced in that passage from Joshua 1:8 that I read at the very outset. Let not this book of the teaching depart from your mouth, but recite it day and night. The exact same verb is used in Joshua as is used here at the very beginning of the book of Psalms. And the mouth, of course, is an organ of speech. Another thing that strengthens this point of the importance of recitation and oral recitation is that we in the modern world, we have an emphasis on reading silently, reading to ourselves. That's a very, very modern phenomenon. Okay, an extremely modern phenomenon. The very word in modern Hebrew means to read in the Bible, and in pre-modern Hebrew means to recite or to proclaim. Okay, so this is very much a public and an oral reading, a recitation of the teaching, to read or to recite or to call. And this was how reading was understood in the ancient Near East, whether it's in Mesopotamia or Israel or Egypt or in the Middle Ages, whether in or even the classical world of Greece and Rome or in medieval Europe or the medieval Islamic world. The Arabic language is a Semitic language, so its word for read and the Hebrew word for read are the exact same word, which has to do with recitation. And in fact, the Islamic scripture is called Quran, which means recitation. Okay? I mean, this is something that you are, the messenger is to recite. Okay? He's commanded, in the Islamic story of their revelation, the angel Gabriel comes to Muhammad and commands him to recite the following words. Okay, so you don't, there's very much an oral component to it. So this inseparable association of reading with recitation, which meant that study is primarily an oral exercise, as I pointed out, is a common feature of all ancient Near Eastern societies and many pre-modern societies. And related to this is that this is to be a constant repetition day and night. And both in the rabbinic tradition, once we no longer have a temple, the recitation of Torah, the study of Torah, the rabbis are going to designate it as, as avodah, okay? Which is the word that Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy uses to describe the service at the temple. Okay, the people who serve at the temple, who perform the sacrifices, they are engaged in avodah. Okay, it is frequently translated as worship. Okay, in English. And there's really not a word for worship in the Hebrew Bible at all. Okay? You'll have Abraham who encounters God and he worships him. This is how it'll be translated. The word that's used in that part of Genesis is that he falls on his face. Okay? He prostrates himself. When we're talking about temple worship, it's not singing and praising because they're disaggregated, as we saw last week. We don't find the temple service as where you have what we think of as worship. Singing and all that stuff, it's not a part of it. That's a separate thing. It's the avodah is the service, the preparing of the animals, the sacrificing of the animals, the cleaning up of the mess, the cooking of the animals, and that kind of thing. So once there is no longer a temple, this study of Torah in the rabbinic tradition is now designated as the same thing, the equivalent of temple service. Okay, because we have no temple left. Yes. Absolutely.
And if so, how is this compare and contrast with what Jesus said about not just repeating when you're praying, not just to be whatever, I can't think.
Rote.
Thank
yes.
you.
That's a good question. The rabbis talk about it all the time, and this is a Protestant church, and we're in the Protestant tradition. We do not have a set liturgy. Well, we have a very set liturgy of service. We just don't realize we have one. Okay, if you look on the bulletin, it says order of service. That's what a liturgy is. Okay, but we don't use the Psalms as something that is read every single week, a different one. We don't have a cycle. We don't have a lectionary. But you do in the Catholic Church, the Lutheran Church, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, they do that. What Jesus is talking about there, there's no rabbi who would disagree with what he is saying there, that you are to recite with your mouth, but also to recite with your heart. Okay? And so there's not a problem with that. But the study is a physical act. So if you go to a yeshiva, you go to a Jewish seminary, the guys are sitting, they're in there and they're all at their desks, but it's noise. Okay, it's like going to like going to the Red Robin. You know, I mean, you don't go there to eat and have a conversation. You go there to eat and yell at each other, right? We went there last night for dinner. But, you know, because if you're going to study, you have to be moving and you have to be, it has to be oral, and because you're following that practice. Yeah. Now, what Jesus particularly condemns is the person who is doing these things and doing it extra loud to call attention to himself. Okay, which again speaks to what it is that Rob was talking about this morning, is that if it's self-referential, you've blown your reward. You've blown your happiness. Okay. But the Qumran community took this quite literally, and they divided themselves up into three groups so that at three watches of the day, you know, in three shifts, the Torah is being recited at all times within their community. You know, some people, this is their job to do it at night, and some people to do it in the morning, and some to do it in the afternoon. So 24 hours a day, day and night, Torah is being recited. Okay, so they take this literally. We find this in some of the monastic orders in Christianity, where you have this very strong emphasis on the daily office of prayers, and that they are at very designated times. And what is the manual of prayer in the Christian tradition? It is the Book of Psalms. Okay, we did not sing any psalms, but almost every single hymn that we sang today quotes some aspect of the psalm. Okay, so the vocabulary of the psalms informs the songs of modern American Protestant Christianity. Yes. No, there's a different word for that, and it certainly sounds like singing, sometimes very bad singing, because not all of us have the greatest voice, but no, they use a very different word for singing, okay, and boy, did I, like, I'm like Rob, I'm being long-winded today. All right, so let's switch gears, and now that we know what the happy person is not, let's look at what he is. And there's very vivid image here. He is like a tree planted beside streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, whose foliage never fades, and whatever it produces thrives. And this is the happy person, okay, who recites Torah. You have a parallel passage in Jeremiah. And Jeremiah, when is Jeremiah active? Those of you who memorized the handouts from last week and did your homework. In the time of Josiah. And when is Josiah around? Yeah. Okay, so this is when the book of Deuteronomy is uncovered. Okay? This is when the emphasis on Torah is much more strong in that period of ancient Israelite history. Okay, and so we have, it's not surprising that we find a very similar invocation in the book of Jeremiah, right? Now here, it's the person whose trust is in God, not someone who recites Torah, but whose trust is in God. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is the Lord alone. He is like a deep-rooted tree by the waterside, putting forth its root along the stream. It does not notice when the heat arrives. Its foliage is evergreen. It has no care in a year of drought. It goes on yielding fruit. Okay, very, very similar passage. And we find this kind of agricultural or arboreal, I guess you could say, you know, stuff to do with trees, this kind of imagery throughout the Bible, and water imagery throughout the Bible, because water is always a problem in agriculture. This is an agricultural society. What's important here for our purposes is that there is a very common word in Hebrew for the word to plant something, and that is not the word that is used here. Okay, it doesn't use the word to plant. It uses the word to be well-rooted, deeply rooted, okay? And I put in your handout this wonderful commentary from the rabbis that this is what they had to say. The text does not say like a tree planted. It doesn't use the word for planted. But rather it says like a tree well rooted. Now why does it say this? Well, they have the reason why is in order to teach that even if all the world's winds were to blast it, they could not dislodge it. And this is a wonderful image here, that when you think of a tree that is well rooted, it's not a tree that when we have high winds and you drive through Fort Collins after we've had a windstorm and you see all these trees over in people's yards. It's not talking about those trees. It's talking about the trees whose roots are deep and whose roots can tap into the water that is nearby these this stream or this pool. And it is perpetually sustained. And because of that, it is a very odd tree. It is a fruit tree that is an evergreen that has leaves. Okay? Its leaves are always green. Its fruit is always there. And it provides shade. Okay? But this is a very important point, that it is a tree who is well rooted, not a tree that is merely planted. Yes?
And did they not see the difference there when it was being translated into these four versions here that all say planted?
Well, it depends on, I mean, that's one of the reasons I gave you four versions of this psalm, four English translations of this psalm, because every translation is a commentary. I'm giving you my commentary. Okay? And in the early 1600s, when the King James was done, you have this big committee. There's a wonderful book that was published in the last few years ago. It was called God's Secretaries. And it was about the process of translating the King James Bible. And I saw the guy on C-SPAN and thought that was sufficient. I didn't have to read his book because it was like a two-hour presentation. But it was very wonderful. I mean, I love that kind of stuff. But the fact that they selected a particular word here has influenced the whole subsequent trajectory of the translation of this text into English. That they chose the word meditate as opposed to recite has affected how these things are translated. In part, that's why the Jewish Publication Society, and I, you know, being the nerdy academic and I use this stuff in class, in the early 80s, they did a new translation in English with an eye to sort of step away from the King James translation, but also to step away from Christological interpretations of the Old Testament for obvious reasons and to try to get back to those kinds of things. So they, you know, some of the English translations do say well-rooted, okay, or deeply rooted, but... that's why I began with the King James Version of this psalm, because one, it's just more poetic English, and also if you're going to give a literal translation of a text, you often, I mean, Hebrew grammar is not English grammar, so the words are in a different order and it becomes very clunky. And I have a number of students that every semester who are from Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or something, and then they write their papers with English words and Arabic grammar, and I recognize the grammar, but so I help them out and to fix that. But translation is a difficult business, but it's always a commentary. So I'm not encouraging. I don't want to encourage you to get all the different translations that you can and read them all, because then you'll just end up like you'll just be confused. And it's like putting your brain in a Cuisinart and just mixing it all up. But so. I think it works. I mean, I think it poetically works. I mean, there's some rhythm to it, and it makes the point. And that's why I included that passage from this rabbinic commentary that, you know, if all of the winds of the world were to prevail against it, it would not become uprooted. Okay? Now, so the foliage of this tree provides shade from the blazing sun of the Near East. And the weather of ancient Israel is very much like the weather of Fort Collins. You know, in the summertime, it is incredibly hot. And it's nice. It's nice that the sun's out, but you need to be in the, you don't want to be out in the blazing sun. It's a heavy sun, and it'll wear you down. Leaves are not only providers of shade, but they are providers of respite from maladies. Okay, and you find Ezekiel and some of the other prophets talking about leaves of healing. Okay, and so you can interpret this passage, and it has been interpreted in both the Jewish and in the Christian tradition, that the leaves of this tree from the study of God's teaching, there is a healing quality to it as well. That's a little bit of a stretch of a literal reading of that passage, but it's certainly part of the interpretive tradition. Now, the final line of verse 3 is rather ambiguous, and it's marvelously ambiguous because it does not, its subject is a pronoun. And the pronouns in Hebrew are, like in Spanish or French, they're masculine and feminine. We don't really have a gendered language in English anymore. So the pronouns can either refer to the tree or the man. Okay, so what is it? Is it the tree that prospers, or is it the man that prospers? Or is it the tree that succeeds or the man that succeeds? And poetry likes to be ambiguous, and there's an awful lot of commentary that has been written with the play on how you can possibly read this here. But not only is the tree well-rooted and is strong and is productive, and its fruit is productive, but the person is well-rooted, and what it is that he undertakes succeeds, but also is fruitful and is of benefit to others. Okay, this is one of the ways that it is understood. Okay, verse 4, very quick transition, which I'm going to do in the last bit that we've got here. Not so the wicked. They're just like chaff. The wind blows it away. Okay, we're not the tree that is well-rooted that all of the winds of the world can blow and it will not go over, but it's the chaff that just a little breeze blows away. That is the wicked. They are the absolute opposite of the well-rooted tree. And within the framework of the worldview of this psalm, he is going to draw on the inevitable conclusion of of this reality. Because the world in the Psalms and in the Hebrew Bible is under the governance of God, because it is God who reigns, Yahweh is the one who reigns, and because there is an inescapable accountability of every human being, the fate of the wicked is inevitable as well. He has no rooting, and the judgment is going to be there. This is a real problem. This is a real problem in verse 5 because it's not entirely clear what this passage means. Literally, it says, "Therefore, wicked people shall not stand up in judgment, nor will hardened sinners in the assembly of the righteous." And what that means depends on how we read the word stand up and judgment. What does that mean? Is that a this worldly judgment? Is that a next worldly judgment? Whose judgment is it? Is it the judgment of God in this world? Is it the judgment of God in the next? And I can assure you that every possible answer to that has been proposed. Okay? And if you look at the psalm as a standalone piece of literature all by itself without any reference to anything else, it's clearly a this worldly understanding. Okay? But in the rabbinic tradition and the Christian tradition, it frequently will be talking about that the day of judgment. It's talking about God's judgment at the end of times. Okay? But I want to look at this, and I want to, for the purposes of our discussion today, say, look at this as judgment in this world. Okay? And what does judgment mean? When you look at the word judgment, we tend to think of, you know, Judge Judy or Judge this guy or Judge Wapner. You know, it's something that a guy in robes and he issues it right now, or that kind of a thing. When you look at this word mishpat, which is the word for judgment here, it's a more, it has more nuances to it than simply getting a judgment in a court. It has to do with God's providence, his constant watchful direction over human affairs or over his creation. He is the one who reigns. He is the one who is in charge. You all have heard the name Jehoshaphat, right? Jumping Jehoshaphat. Well, Jehoshaphat is this word mishpat. It is Yeho is Yahweh. Shaphat is my judge, is my protector, is my sustainer, my provider. So it would be a horrible name to give your children, but it is a wonderful name and a potent name, and there's a reason why that name was used. Okay, but it would, you know, your kids would be teased out of their minds if you gave it to them nowadays. Okay, so the idea is that reward and punishment are meted out by God in this life in response to virtue and wickedness. And we see this over and over and over again throughout the Hebrew Bible, that judgment is in this world. There is a benefit, there is a blessing for the righteous, and punishment for the wicked. And as the Hebrew Bible goes along, this theological proposition runs into problems. And people find, you know, well, what about, you know, Psalm 37? What about Psalm 73? What about the book of Job? Okay, that black and white dichotomy of blessing for the righteous and punishment for the wicked just doesn't work. It doesn't apply in the same way that it is articulated here. But the idea is that for the person who is following and who is reciting and who is meditating and focusing on God's instruction, the providence of God will be there. Okay, and the person who doesn't do that will not stand in that judgment, will not be under that protection and provision. So let's pass along onto the next thing. The final verse of the psalm is that the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked is doomed. And this is set up as an antonym, you know, as opposites. And this is another. This is one of the things that makes you lucky, that I get to explain words to you. Okay. Now, if I were doing this in church, people would be bored out of their mind. I realize that, but you guys are the special people, and I really thank you for showing up. Okay. Well, nobody's named Ed in here, are you? Yeah. Okay. So it's not special Ed. No. The word in English, we have one word for no. Right? We know. I know you. I know this. I know God. I don't know God. I know that. Well, all that kind of thing. How we qualify what kind of knowledge is with adjectives and prepositions. In Hebrew, there are a number of words for knowledge. And that is it's a problem, or it presents a problem. It's not a real problem, but it presents a problem. When you give a literal word-for-word translation for, yeah, this word means no. So to say that the Lord knows the way of the righteous, that is correct. But what does that knowledge entail? If you were to use this word to know, and you were to say, and you were to speak in modern Hebrew, and you were to, this is the mistake that all Americans make when they're learning Hebrew, and you say that I know so-and-so, and you use this word, they would laugh because you had just said that I have sex with so-and-so. Okay? We use the phrase to know in the biblical sense, right? So this word for knowledge conveys with it, or includes in it, you know, sexual intimacy, emotional intimacy. It's not this cognitive knowledge, but it's passion and protection and intimacy that is something that is beyond cognition, but something that is affective. We talk about head knowledge and heart knowledge in English. That's how we can define those, or distinguish those two. We're talking about the heart knowledge here, but this is the knowledge that we have here. So in the Some of the translations says God or the Lord cherishes the righteous. Okay, so this knowledge that God has is something that is intimate and loving and caring. Okay, but how is it that to know something is the opposite of being doomed? Okay, and the answer really comes back to that difference of the word to know. Emotional ties, empathy, intimacy, sexual experience, mutuality, mutual responsibility, all of these things have to do with this verb to know. Okay, in the use of this term, and this is used in law codes in the ancient Near East, a king knows his people. That means that he has obligations to his people. And a people know their king. That means that the people have obligations to their king. It's just not that you know them, but there is a relational aspect to this word. And what's interesting here is that by declaring that the Lord knows the way of the righteous, of the tzaddik, the psalm is affirming that God maintains a special relationship with the righteous. And they are under his personal care, they're under his guidance, and he orders and sustains their pattern of life and their destiny. And how does he do that? He does that through his teaching. And how is it that you achieve or you find yourself in that state of happiness? It's because you have meditated on his teaching day and night. The wicked, on the other hand, they are doomed. They're doomed not by God. They are doomed by themselves. Look at that sentence. The way of the wicked is doomed. God knows the righteous. The way of the wicked is doomed. Okay, and I'm going to be really annoying here. The way of the wicked, the way is the subject. And it is governed by a state of intransitive verb, is, okay? Which means that the way is doomed. Whereas in the beginning of that sentence, it is God himself who knows, who cherishes, who preserves, who protects, who cares for the righteous. Okay, he is the one who is the active subject. But it's the way, just by pursuing that way, it is what dooms you. And so the wicked have doomed themselves. They have willfully distanced themselves from God. And so we're back to the, now I can tell you why we have the title for today, that it is the moral individual, the righteous individual, the person who pursues and recites and meditates on God's Torah, that has triumphed in an immoral society. Because there is no mention in this psalm to leave society. Okay? You're not to leave society. You are in society. And in the midst of that society, you are well rooted and you will triumph and you will not be blown away. And so we are able to invoke what the rabbis had to say, that even if the winds of all of the world were to blow against the tree, it is well rooted and nothing can uproot it. And that is what we have when we are focused on, when we are reciting, when we are meditating on the instruction of the Lord. And that sets the tone for the entirety of the rest of the book. And that is an example of devotion. It is an example of piety. And it is the example of what we are commanded to do in God's instruction. Okay, so one of the things that, if you're going to go hear Rob at 11:30, you will see that he's going to be reading out of this, the 15th chapter of Acts. And there is the contrast, and you find this contrast in Christian theology a lot, between law and grace. And the law is this, and the law is, and it takes on a very negative connotation. And in a narrow understanding of that term, that makes sense. But that's not what this Torah is in this psalm, or how Torah is understood in the Bible or even in the time period of early Christianity. Because the only Bible that existed in the early church is what we call the Old Testament. And so to put away and to demean and to reject the law of God, as somehow sometimes people will set up that dichotomy, is to throw away the whole Bible. And that would be, in my opinion, a mistake. And in the church's opinion, it was a mistake, and that is why Marcion in the 200s was excommunicated, because that was his position, that we should get rid of the Old Testament and only have part of the New Testament. Okay, that position is rejected. So when you read your Old Testament from now on and you see the word law, it's Torah. And I would hope that you would be able to sort of get beyond the idea that law is just do this and don't do that. The commandments or the mitzvot that are mentioned in the books of Moses are called Torah because they instruct. They are not called Torah just because they tell you you have to do this and you don't do that. The book of Psalms is Torah. The prophetic books themselves are Torah. It is all God's instruction as the Bible understands Torah. Okay? So, any questions on that? All right. So as we work our way through the rest of the Psalms that we're going to look at this semester, read them as Torah. Read them to be instructed. Close your door and recite them. Read them aloud. All right. Let's close real quick here. Father, I thank you for your Torah. I thank you for your teaching, for your instruction and your guidance. And Father, I thank you especially for your care and your judgment and protection over us. May we be a people who are happy because we delight in your Torah and we recite it day and night, as is our example here in this psalm. Go with us as we go throughout the week and bring us back together safe next week. In Jesus' name, amen.